This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents The Happiness Advantage, the 7 principles of positive psychology that fuel success and performance at work by Sean Acor. This is Sean Acor. Part 1, Positive Psychology at Work. Introduction. If you observe the people around you, you'll find most individuals follow a formula that has been subtly, or not so subtly, taught to them by their schools, their company, their parents, or society. That is, if you work hard, you will become successful. And once you become successful, then you'll be happy. This pattern of belief explains what most often motivates us in life. We think, if I can just get that raise, or hit that next sales target, I'll be happy. If I can just get that next good grade, I'll be happy. If I lose that 5 pounds, I'll be happy, and so on. Success first, happiness second. The only problem is that this formula is broken. If success causes happiness, then every employee who gets a promotion, every student who receives an acceptance letter, everyone who has ever accomplished a goal of any kind should be happy. But with each victory, our goalposts of success keep getting pushed further and further out, so that happiness gets pushed over the horizon. Even more important, the formula is broken because it is backward. More than a decade of groundbreaking research in the fields of positive psychology and neuroscience has proven, in no uncertain terms, that the relationship between success and happiness works the other way around. Thanks to this cutting-edge science, we now know that happiness is the precursor to success, not merely the result, and that happiness and optimism actually fuel performance and achievement, giving us the competitive edge that I call the happiness advantage. Waiting to be happy limits our brain's potential for success, whereas cultivating positive brains makes us more motivated, efficient, resilient, creative, and productive, which drives performance upward. This discovery has been confirmed by thousands of scientific studies and in my own work and research on 1,600 Harvard students and dozens of Fortune 500 companies worldwide. In this audio program, you will learn not only why the happiness advantage is so powerful, but how you can use it on a daily basis to increase your success at work. But I'm getting excited and jumping ahead of myself. I begin this program where I began my research, at Harvard, where the happiness advantage was born. Discovering the happiness advantage. I applied to Harvard on a dare. I was raised in Waco, Texas, and never really expected to leave. Even as I was applying to Harvard, I was setting down roots and training to be a local volunteer firefighter. For me, Harvard was a place from the movies, the place mothers joke about their kids going to when they grow up. The chances of actually getting in were infinitesimally small. I told myself I'd be happy just to tell my kids someday, offhandedly at dinner, that I had even applied to Harvard. I imagined my imaginary children being quite impressed. When I unexpectedly got accepted, I felt thrilled and humbled by the privilege. I wanted to do the opportunity justice, so I went to Harvard, and I stayed, for the next 12 years. When I left Waco, I had been out of Texas 4 times, and never out of the country, though Texans consider anything out of Texas foreign travel. But as soon as I stepped out of the T in Cambridge and into Harvard Yard, I fell in love. So after getting my BA, I found a way to stay. I went to grad school, taught sections in 16 different courses, and then began delivering lectures. As I pursued my graduate studies, I also became a proctor, an officer of Harvard hired to live in residence with the undergraduates to help them navigate the difficult path to both academic success and happiness within the ivory tower. This effectively meant that I lived in a college dorm for a total of 12 years of my life, not a fact I brought up on first dates. I tell you this for 2 reasons. First, because I saw Harvard as such a privilege, it fundamentally changed the way my brain processed my experience. I felt grateful for every moment, even in the midst of stress, exams, and blizzards, something else I had only seen in the movies. Second, my 12 years teaching in the classrooms and living in the dorms afforded me a comprehensive view of how thousands of other Harvard students advanced through the stresses and challenges of their college years. That's when I began noticing the patterns. Paradise Lost and Found. Around the time that Harvard was founded, John Milton wrote in Paradise Lost, "The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven." 300 years later, I observed this principle come to life. Many of my students saw Harvard as a privilege, but others quickly lost sight of that reality and focused only on the workload, the competition, the stress. They fretted incessantly about their future, despite the fact that they were earning a degree that would open so many doors. They felt overwhelmed by every small setback instead of energized by the possibilities in front of them. And after watching enough of those students struggle to make their way through, something dawned on me. Not only were these students the ones who seemed most susceptible to stress and depression, they were the ones whose grades and academic performance were suffering the most. Years later, in the fall of 2009, I was invited to go on a month-long speaking tour throughout Africa. During the trip, a CEO from South Africa named Salim took me to Soweto, a township just outside of Johannesburg that many inspiring people, including Nelson Mandela and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, have called their home. We visited a school next to a shanty town where there was no electricity and scarce running water. Only when I was in front of the children did it dawn on me that none of the stories I normally told in my talks would work. Sharing the research and experiences of privileged American college students and wealthy, powerful business leaders seemed inappropriate. So I tried to open a dialogue. Struggling for points of common experience, I asked in a very clearly tongue-in-cheek tone, "Who here likes to do schoolwork?" I thought the seemingly universal distaste for schoolwork would bond us together. But to my shock, 95% of the children raised their hands and started smiling genuinely and enthusiastically. Afterward, I jokingly asked Salim why the children of Soweto were so weird. "They see their schoolwork as a privilege," he replied, "one that many of their parents did not have." When I returned to Harvard 2 weeks later, I saw students complaining about the very thing the Soweto students saw as a privilege. I started to realize just how much our interpretation of reality changes our experience of that reality. The students who were so focused on stress and the pressure, the ones who saw learning as a chore, were missing out on all of the opportunities right in front of them. But those who saw attending Harvard as a privilege seemed to shine even brighter. Almost unconsciously at first, and then with ever-increasing interest, I became fascinated with what caused those high-potential individuals to develop a positive mindset to excel, especially in such a competitive environment. And likewise, what caused those who succumbed to the pressure to fail or stay stuck in a negative or neutral position? Researching happiness at Hogwarts. For me, Harvard remains a magical place, even after 12 years. When I invite friends from Texas to visit, they claim that eating in the freshman dining hall is like being at Hogwarts, Harry Potter's fantastical school of magic. Add in the other beautiful buildings, the university's abundant resources, and the seemingly endless opportunities it offers. And my friends often end up asking, "Sean, why would you waste your time studying happiness at Harvard? Seriously, what does a Harvard student possibly have to be unhappy about?" In Milton's time, Harvard had a motto that reflected the school's religious roots: Veritas, Christo, et Ecclesia. Truth for Christ and the Church. For many years now, that motto has been truncated to a single word: Veritas, or just truth. There are many truths at Harvard, and one of them is that despite all of its magnificent facilities, a wonderful faculty, and a student body made up of some of America's and the world's best and brightest, It is home to many chronically unhappy young men and women. In 2004, for example, a Harvard Crimson poll found that as many as 4 in 5 Harvard students suffer from depression at least once during the school year, and nearly half of all students suffer from depression so debilitating they can't function. This unhappiness epidemic is not unique to Harvard. A Conference Board survey released in January of 2010 found that only 45% of workers surveyed were happy at their jobs, the lowest in 22 years of polling. Depression rates today are 10 times higher than they were in 1960. Every year, the age threshold of unhappiness sinks lower, not just at the universities, but across the nation. 50 years ago, the mean onset age of depression was 29 and a half years of age. Today, it is almost exactly half that, 14 and a half years old. My friends wanted to know, why study happiness at Harvard? The question I asked in response was, why not start there? So I set out to find the students, those 1 in 5 who were truly flourishing, the individuals who were above the curve in terms of their happiness, performance, achievement, productivity, humor, energy, or resilience, to see what exactly was giving them such an advantage over their peers. What was it that allowed these people to escape the gravitational pull of the norm? Could patterns be teased out of their lives and experience to help others in all walks of life to be more successful in an increasingly stressful and negative world? As it turns out, they could. Scientific discovery is a lot about timing and luck. I serendipitously found 3 mentors, Harvard professors Phil Stone, Ellen Langer, and Tal Ben-Shahar, who happened to be at the vanguard of a brand new field called positive psychology. Breaking with traditional psychology's focus on what makes people unhappy and how they can return to normal, these 3 were applying the same scientific rigor to what makes people thrive and excel. The very same questions I wanted to answer. Escaping the cult of the average. Imagine in your mind a graph with a series of 100 dots that all follow exactly on a line and a curve upward. All the dots fit on that line, except for one weird dot that's way above the curve. That graph may seem boring to you, but that graph is the very reason I wake up and get excited every morning. Clearly, I live a very exciting life. It is also the basis of the research underlying this book. This graph that I describe is a scatterplot diagram. Each dot on a graph like that represents an individual, and each axis represents some variable. This particular graph could be plotting anything: weight in relationship to height, sleep in relationship to energy, happiness in relationship to success, and so on. If we got this data back as researchers, we would be thrilled, because very clearly there is a trend going on here, and that means we can get published, which in the academic world is all that really matters. The fact that there is that one weird dot, what we call an outlier, up above the curve, is no problem. It's no problem because we can just delete it. We can delete it because it's clearly a measurement error. And we know that it's an error because it's screwing up our data. One of the very first things students in intro psychology, statistics, or economics courses learn is how to clean up their data. If you are interested in observing the general trend of what you're researching, then outliers mess up your findings. That's why there exist countless formulas and statistics packages to help enterprising researchers eliminate these problems. And to be clear, this is not cheating. These are statistically valid procedures, if, that is, one is interested only in the general trend. I am not. The typical approach to understanding human behavior has always been to look for the average behavior or outcome. But in my view, this misguided approach has created what I call the cult of the average in the behavioral sciences. If someone asks a question such as, how fast can a child learn how to read in a classroom? Science changes that question to, how fast does the average child learn how to read in the classroom? We then ignore the children who read faster or slower, and tailor the classroom towards the average child. That's the first mistake traditional psychology makes. If we study what is merely average, we will remain merely average. Conventional psychology consciously ignores outliers because they don't fit the pattern. I've sought to do the opposite. Instead of deleting these outliers, I want to learn from them. Too focused on the negative. True, there are psychology researchers out there who don't just study what is average. They tend to focus on those who fall only on one side of the average, below it. This is the second mistake traditional psychology makes. Of course, the people who fall below normal are the ones who tend to need the most help, to be relieved of depression or alcohol abuse or chronic stress. As a result, psychologists understandably have spent considerable effort studying how they can help these people recover and get back to normal. Valuable as such work is, it still only yields half the picture. You can eliminate depression without making someone happy. You can cure anxiety without teaching someone optimism. You can return someone to work without improving their job performance. If all you strive for is diminishing the bad, you will only attain the average, and you'll miss out entirely on the opportunity to exceed the average. You can study gravity forever without learning how to fly. Extraordinarily, as late as 1998, there was a 17-to-1 negative to positive ratio of research in the field of psychology. In other words, for every one study about happiness and thriving, there were 17 studies on depression and disorder. This is very telling. As a society, we know very well how to be unwell and miserable, and so little about how to thrive. A few years back, one event in particular really drove this home for me. I had been asked to speak at the Wellness Week at one of the most elite New England boarding schools. The topics to be discussed: Monday, eating disorders; Tuesday, depression; Wednesday, drugs and violence; Thursday, risky sex; and Friday, who knew? That's not a wellness week. That's a sickness week. This pattern of focusing on the negative pervades not only our research in schools, but our society. Turn on the news and the majority of airtime is spent on accidents, corruption, murders, and abuse. This focus on the negative tricks our brains into believing that this sorry ratio is reality, that most of our life is negative. Ever heard of the medical school syndrome? In the first year of medical school, as students listen to all these diseases and symptoms that can befall a person, many aspiring doctors become suddenly convinced that they have come down with all of them. A few years ago, my brother-in-law called me from Yale Medical School and told me that he had leprosy, which even at Yale is extremely rare. But I had no idea how to console him because he had just gotten over a week of menopause and was very sensitive. The point is, as we will see throughout this audio program, what we spend our time and mental energy focusing on can indeed become our reality. It is not healthy nor scientifically responsible only to study the negative half of human experience. In 1998, Martin Seligman, then president of the American Psychological Association, announced that it was finally time to shift the traditional approach to psychology and start to focus more on the positive side of the curve. Then we need to study what works, not just what is broken. Thus, positive psychology was born. Going hungry at Harvard. In 2006, Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar asked if I would serve as the head teaching fellow to help design and teach a course called Positive Psychology. Tal was not yet internationally well known. His best-selling book, Happier, wouldn't be published until the following spring. Under the circumstances, we thought we'd be lucky to lure in 100 undergraduates brave enough to risk a hit on their transcripts by foregoing a credit in, say, advanced economic theory, for one in happiness. When we walked into the classroom that very first day, nearly 1,000 undergraduates were packed into the auditorium waiting for us. That's one in every 7 students at one of the most hard-driving universities in the world. We quickly began to realize that these students were there because they were hungry. They were starving to be happier, not just sometime in the future, but in the present. and they were there because despite all the advantages they enjoyed, they still felt unfulfilled. Take a moment to imagine one of these students. By age one, many were lying in their cribs wearing a onesie saying, "Bound for Harvard," or maybe a cute little Yale hat in case something terrible happened. Since they were in pre-kindergarten, which in some cases they were enrolled in even before being conceived, they were in the top 1% of their class, and then the top 1% of those who took standardized testing along the way. They won awards, they broke records. This kind of high achievement was not just encouraged, it was expected. I know one Harvard student whose mother would keep every handwriting exercise and restaurant placemat drawing he ever did, because this is going to be in a museum someday, she would say. That was a lot of pressure on me, Mom. And then they get into Harvard, walk confidently into that Hogwarts-like freshman dining hall on the first day of college, and have a terrible realization. 50% of them are suddenly below average. I like to tell my advisees, if my calculations are correct, 99% of Harvard students do not graduate in the top 1%. They don't find that joke very funny. With so much pressure to be great, it is no surprise to find that when these kids fall, they fall hard. To make matters worse, this pressure and the depression that follows pulls people inward, away from their friends, families, and social supports, at a time when they need the support the most. They skip meals, shut themselves in their rooms or in the library, emerging only for the occasional kegger, and then in an attempt to blow off steam, they get too drunk to even enjoy themselves, or at least remember enjoying themselves. They even seem too busy, too preoccupied, and too stressed to reach out for love. Based on my study of Harvard undergraduates, the average number of romantic relationships over 4 years is less than one. The average number of sexual partners, if you're curious, is 0.5 per student. I have no idea what 0.5 sexual partners means, but it sounds like the scientific equivalent of second base. In my survey, I found that among these brilliant Harvard students, 24% are unaware if they are currently involved in any romantic relationship. What was going on here was that, like so many people in contemporary society, along the way to gaining their superb educations and their shiny opportunities, they had absorbed the wrong lessons. They had mastered formulas in calculus and chemistry. They had read great books and learned world history and become fluent in foreign languages. But they had never formally been taught how to maximize their brain's potential or how to find meaning and happiness. Armed with iPhones and personal digital assistants, they had multitasked their way through a storm of resume-building experiences, often at the expense of actual ones. In their pursuit of high achievement, they had isolated themselves from their peers and loved ones, and thus compromised the very support systems they so ardently needed. Repeatedly, I noticed these patterns in my own students, who often broke down under the tyranny of expectations we place on ourselves and those around us. Brilliant people sometimes do the most unintelligent thing possible. In the midst of stress, rather than investing, these individuals divested from the greatest predictor of success and happiness, their social support network. Countless studies have found that social relationships are the best guarantee of heightened well-being and lowered stress, both an antidote for depression and a prescription for high performance. But instead, these students have somehow learned that when the going gets tough, the tough get going, to an isolated cubicle in the library basement. These best and brightest willingly sacrificed happiness for success because, like so many of us, they have been taught that if you work hard, you will be successful. And only then, once you are successful, will you be happy. They have been taught that happiness is the reward you get when you become partner of an investment firm, win the Nobel Prize, or get elected to Congress. But in fact, as you will learn throughout this audio program, new research in psychology and neuroscience shows that it works the other way around. We become more successful when we are happier and more positive. For example, doctors put in a positive mood before making a diagnosis show almost 3 times more intelligence and creativity than doctors in a neutral state, and they make accurate diagnoses 19% faster. Optimistic salespeople outsell their pessimistic counterparts by 56%. Students primed to feel happy before taking math achievement tests far outperform their neutral peers. It turns out that our brains are literally hardwired to perform at their best, not when they are negative or neutral, but when they are positive. Yet in today's world, we ironically sacrifice happiness for success only to lower our brain success rates. Our hard-driving lives leave us feeling stressed, and we feel swamped by the mounting pressure to succeed at any cost. Listening to the positive outliers. The more I studied the research emerging from the field of positive psychology, the more I learned how wrong-headed we are, not just the Harvard students, but all of us, in our beliefs about personal and professional fulfillment. Studies conclusively showed that the quickest way to high achievement is not a single-minded concentration on work, and that the best way to motivate employees is not to bark orders and foster a stressed and fearful workforce. Instead, radical new research on happiness and optimism were turning both the academic and the corporate worlds upside down. I immediately saw an opportunity. I could test these ideas out on my students. I could design a study to see if these new ideas indeed explain why some students were thriving while others succumbed to stress and depression. By studying the patterns and habits of people above the curve, I could glean information about not just how to move us up to the average, but how to move the entire average up. Luckily, I was in a unique position to conduct this research. As a freshman proctor, I'd been blessed for a dozen years with an incredible up-close view of these students, what their habits are, what makes them tick, and what we can learn from their experiences to apply to our own lives. I'd been able to read all the admissions files, see the admissions committee's comments, watch the students progress intellectually and socially, and see what jobs they received after college. I also ended up grading a large percentage of them in the classroom as a teaching fellow for 16 different courses. To get to know the students beyond just their exams and transcripts, I began meeting with my students in what I call my coffice, half coffee, half office, in Starbucks to hear their stories. By my calculation, I've sat for more than a half hour individually with over 1,100 Harvard students, enough caffeine to get an entire Olympic team disqualified for decades. I then took these observations and used them to design and conduct my own empirical survey of 1,600 high-achieving undergraduates, one of the largest studies on happiness ever performed on students at Harvard. At the same time, I continued to steep myself in the positive psychology research that was suddenly exploding out of my own institution and out of university laboratories around the world. The result? Surprising and exciting conclusions about what causes some to rise to the top and thrive in challenging environments, while others sink down and never become what they have in them to be. What I found, and what you're about to hear, was revealing, not just for Harvard, but for all of us in the working world. The Seven Principles. Once I'd finished gathering and analyzing this massive amount of research, I was able to isolate seven specific, actionable, and proven patterns that predict success and achievement. The Happiness Advantage. Because positive brains have a biological advantage over brains that are neutral or negative, this principle teaches us how to retrain our brains to capitalize on positivity and improve our productivity and performance. The fulcrum and the lever. How we experience the world and our ability to succeed within it constantly changes based upon our mindset. This principle teaches us how we can adjust our mindset, our fulcrum, in a way that gives us the power, the lever, to be more fulfilled and successful. The Tetris Effect. When our brains get stuck in a pattern that focuses on stress, negativity, and failure, we set ourselves up to fail. This principle teaches us how to retrain our brains to spot patterns of possibility, so we can see and seize opportunity wherever we look. Falling up. In the midst of defeat, stress, and crisis, our brains map different paths to help us cope. This principle is about finding the mental path that not only leads us up out of our failure or suffering, but teaches us to be happier and more successful because of it. The Zorro Circle. When challenges loom and we get overwhelmed, our rational brains can get hijacked by emotions. This principle teaches us how to regain control by focusing first on the small, manageable goals, and then gradually expanding our circle to achieve bigger and bigger ones. The 22nd rule. Sustaining lasting change often feels impossible because our willpower is limited. And when willpower fails, we fall back on our old habits and succumb to the path of least resistance. This principle shows how, by making small energy adjustments, we can reroute the path of least resistance and replace bad habits with good ones. Social investment. In the midst of challenges and stress, some people choose to hunker down and retreat within themselves. But the most successful people invest in their friends, peers, and family members to propel themselves forward. This principle teaches us how to invest more in one of our greatest predictors of success and excellence, our social support network. Together, these 7 principles helped Harvard students, and later tens of thousands of people in the real world, overcome obstacles, reverse bad habits, become more efficient and productive, make the most of opportunities, conquer their most ambitious goals, and reach their fullest potential. Out of the ivory tower. While I loved working with students, what I really wanted was to see if these same principles could also drive happiness and success in the real world. To bridge the gap between academia and business, I formed a small consulting firm called Aspirant to help deliver and test this research at companies and nonprofit organizations. A month later, the global economy began to collapse. The happiness advantage at work. Flying over the savannas of Zimbabwe in the fall of 2008, I suddenly began to feel nervous. How could I lecture to people on happiness research in a country that had just been devastated by the complete implosion of their financial system, not to mention one ruled by dictator Robert Mugabe? When I landed in the city of Harare, I was taken to dinner by some local business leaders. In the dim candlelight, one of them asked me, "Sean, how many trillionaires do you know?" I said jokingly, "Very few." He then said, "Raise your hand if you were a trillionaire." Everyone sitting on the floor at the dinner table raised their hands. Seeing my shocked response, another person explained, "Don't be impressed. The very last time I used a Zim dollar, I spent a trillion to buy a chocolate bar." Zimbabwe had just been devastated by the complete collapse of its currency. All the financial institutions were struggling to survive. The country had even moved to a barter system for a while. In the midst of this, I worried that my research would fall on ears deafened by the concussions of repeated crisis. But to my surprise, I found people more eager than ever to hear about the research behind the principles. They wanted to bounce back from this challenge stronger than before, and they knew they needed a whole new set of tools to do so. The real world. While I've since found that my 7 principles of positive psychology have extraordinary applications in the workplace, in both good times and bad, the economic collapse very quickly crystallized the need, not just to help businesses and professionals preserve their well-being, but to help them to maximize their energy, productivity, and performance when they needed it the most. They recognized it too, for I suddenly found many once invincible businesses reaching out their hands for help. Within 1 year, I had spoken to businesses in 40 countries across 5 continents and found that the same principles that predicted success at Harvard worked everywhere I went. For a boy from Waco who hadn't traveled much, it was a humbling experience to meet so many people across the world, each with a different story of happiness, hardship, and resilience. It was also a time of great learning. I learned more about happiness during my travels to Africa and the Middle East in the midst of a crisis than in 12 years of sheltered study. The fruit of that labor and research is this book. From Wall Street traders to Tanzanian school teachers to salespeople in Rome, they all could use the now crisis-tempered principles to propel themselves forward. In October 2008, I was brought into American Express to speak to a group of vice presidents. AIG had just become a ward of the Federal Reserve. Lehman Brothers had gone under, the Dow was at a record low. So when I walked into the room at American Express, the mood was grim. Tired-looking executives looked at me ashen-faced, and their BlackBerries, usually chirping incessantly at the start of these events, had fallen silent. Massive layoffs, leadership reorganization, and a decision to restructure into a bank had been announced 30 minutes before my 90-minute talk on happiness. This was not going to be a receptive audience, or so I thought. I assumed, just as I had in Zimbabwe, that the last thing a group of people so distraught and unnerved would be interested in hearing about was positive psychology. Yet again, it turned out to be one of the most engaged and receptive groups I have ever encountered. The 90 minutes turned into nearly 3 hours as executives canceled appointments and postponed meetings. Like the nearly 1,000 students who showed up for that first Harvard class on the subject, these highly sophisticated financiers were hungry to understand the new science of happiness and how it could bring them success in their jobs and careers. The earliest adopters of the happiness advantage were the world's largest banks, as they were the first to get hit. I began researching and teaching the principles in this book to thousands of senior leaders, managing directors, and CEOs at some of the world's biggest and most battered financial institutions. Then I began to branch out to people and companies in all other sectors who had been hit hard by the meltdown. These were not happy times, nor happy audiences. But regardless of their industry, company, or rank in the organization, rather than resistance, I found people almost universally open to learning how to use positive psychology to rethink the way they did their work. Inoculating against stress. Meanwhile, positive psychology researchers had finished a meta-analysis, a study of nearly every scientific happiness study available, over 200 studies on 275,000 people worldwide. Their findings exactly matched the principles I was teaching, that happiness leads to success in nearly every domain, including work, health, friendship, sociability, creativity, and energy. This encouraged me to apply the principles to other populations. Tax auditors, for instance, are not known for happiness. But if we're going to test the effectiveness of the happiness advantage in the working world, I wanted to see if teaching the 7 principles could raise the happiness, well-being, and resilience of an accounting firm right before they went into the most stressful tax season in decades. So in December of 2008, I gave 3 hours of positive psychology training to 250 managers at KPMG. Then I returned to see if the training had helped inoculate these individuals against the negative effects of stress. Testing showed that the principles did just that, and in very short order. The group of auditors who had gone through the training reported significantly higher life satisfaction scores and lower stress scores than a control group who had not received the training. So it went at UBS, Credit Suisse, Morgan Stanley, and countless other beleaguered giants. In the midst of the largest downturn in modern memory, companies were instituting no-fly restrictions for their employees, similar to wartime when you think about it, tightening their belts, trying to survive. Yet they found room in their budgets for my trainings on this research. The leaders of these companies recognized that more than just technical skills would be required to help their company rise above the challenging circumstances. Soon law schools and law firms also began knocking at the door. Understandably so. Researchers have discovered that lawyers have more than 3 times the depression rate of the average occupational group, and that law students suffer from dangerously elevated levels of mental distress. Several Harvard Law School students told me that they often studied at the smaller education school library because just being in the same room with other law students, even if no one said a word, spread negative stress like secondhand smoke. To attack this thorny reality, I taught the 7 principles to focus groups of lawyers and law students across the country. We talked about how using a positive mindset could gain them a competitive edge, how building up their social support systems could eradicate anxiety, and how they could buffer themselves against the negativity that spread rapidly from one library cubicle to another. Again, the results were immediate and impressive. even in the midst of their heavy workloads and tyranny of impossible expectations. These hard-driving individuals were able to use the happiness advantage to reduce stress and achieve more in their academic and professional lives. Spreading the word. Despite the academic explosion of positive psychology, its groundbreaking findings are still mostly a secret. When I started in graduate school, I was told that the average academic journal article is read by only 7 people. This is an extraordinarily depressing statistic, because I know that the number has to include the researcher's mom. That means we're down to about 6 people who read these studies. This is a travesty, because scientists are making incredible discoveries daily that reveal how the human brain works best and how we can best relate to one another. And yet, only 6 people and 1 proud mom are privy to this information. The more I traveled, the more I found that the groundbreaking findings of positive psychology are still mostly unknown in the business and professional fields. Lawyers who suffer from unbearable stress are unaware that specific techniques have already been developed to buffer them against this occupational hazard. Teachers in inner-city schools don't know about the study that isolated the top 2 patterns of successful teaching. Fortune 500 companies are still using incentive programs that were proven ineffective almost a generation ago. As a result, they miss an incredible opportunity to get ahead. If a study has proven how CEOs can become 15% more productive, or how managers can improve customer satisfaction by 42%, then I think the people in the trenches should know about it, and not just a handful of academics. The point of this audio program is to arm you with that research, so that you will know exactly how you can use the principles of positive psychology to gain a competitive advantage in your career and in the workplace. Raising performance, not delusion. Grounded in 2 decades of research that has revolutionized the field of psychology, and further shaped by my own study of the science of happiness and success, the principles that form the core of this audio program have also been field-tested and refined through my work with everyone from global financiers to grade schoolers, surgeons to attorneys, accountants to UN ambassadors. In essence, there are a set of tools that anyone, no matter their profession or calling, can use to achieve more every day. The best part about them is that they don't only work in a business setting. They can help you overcome obstacles, reverse bad habits, become more efficient and productive, make the most of opportunities, and help you to conquer your most ambitious goals in life and in work. In essence, there are a set of 7 tools you can use to achieve more every day. Here is what they will not do. They will not tell you to paint on a happy face, use positive thinking to wish away your problems, or worse, to pretend your problems don't exist. I'm not here to tell you that everything always comes up roses. If there's anything the past few years have taught me, it's that this view is deluded. As I once heard a managing director at a large financial institution complain, it's 1 p.m., and 6 times today, I've heard that the company has turned the corner. If we've turned the corner 6 times, I don't know where we are. The happiness advantage starts at a different place. It asks us to be realistic about the present while maximizing our potential for the future. It is about learning how to cultivate the mindset and behaviors that have been empirically proven to fuel greater success and fulfillment. It is a work ethic. Happiness is not the belief that we don't need to change. It is the realization that we can. Change is possible. A behavioral riddle. You're in a cage behind bars. The bars are made of titanium and your cage is empty. To survive, you must consume 240 tiny pellets of food every hour. The pellets are provided to you, but unfortunately, are located in very small holes outside of your cage. So the process of reaching through the bars and actually grabbing a pellet initially takes you 30 seconds per pellet. If you can't learn to complete the task faster, you will only consume half the amount of nutrition you need and will eventually starve. What do you do? The answer? Expand the part of your brain in charge of this task so you can become faster at retrieving the pellets. Impossible, right? Well, not so fast. This riddle is, in fact, based upon a famous study in the field of neuroscience. Only the subjects in the experiments were not humans, but squirrel monkeys. After 500 tries, the monkeys had become very adept at retrieving the pellets, even as the size of the hole continually decreased. So even though the task became harder, through practice they began to master it, like a young piano student who learns to master a scale. Intuitively, this makes sense. We've all heard the saying, practice makes perfect. But where it gets really interesting is when researchers looked at what was happening in the monkeys' brains as they got faster and faster retrieving the pellets. Using strategically placed electrodes, researchers were able to establish the areas of the brain that showed activity when a monkey was first faced with this conundrum. Then they tracked their brain function as the monkeys reached for pellets over and over. When the researchers looked at the brain scans at the end of the experiment, they found that the amount of cortical area being activated by the task had increased several times over. In other words, through mere practice, each monkey had literally expanded the sections of its brain necessary for accomplishing this task. And not over countless generations through the process of evolution, but over the course of one experiment conducted over just a few months. Great, you might say, for squirrel monkeys. But for the most part, we don't hire monkeys in our organizations, at least not on purpose. But recent advances in neuroscience have proven that this process works identically in humans. A short course in neuroplasticity. I'm wired to be unhappy. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. Some people are just born cynical and will never change. Women are not good at math. I'm just not a funny person. She's a born athlete. Or so goes the established train of thought in our culture. Our potential is biologically fixed. Once a brain reaches maturity, it's pointless to try and change it. Without the ability to make lasting positive change, a book like The Happiness Advantage would be a cruel joke, a nice pat on the back for the already happy and successful among us, but useless for the rest. What good is the discovery that happiness fuels success if we can't actually become happier? The belief that we are just our genes is one of the most pernicious myths in modern culture. The insidious notion that people come into the world with a fixed set of abilities and that they, and their brains, cannot change. The scientific community is partly to blame for this, because for decades, scientists refused to see what potential for change was staring them right in the face. To explain, let me take you back to Africa. The African unicorn. In ancient Egypt, carvings and writings spoke of a mythical creature, half zebra, half giraffe. When 19th century British traders found these carvings, they described this beast as the African unicorn, a fantasy creature and biological impossibility. However, natives of the Congo Basin insisted that they had sighted exactly such an animal deep within the forest. Even without the aid of modern genetics, the British explorers knew that this was ridiculous. Giraffes simply did not mate with zebras, and certainly did not produce offspring. Zebras might think giraffes have great personalities, but they just don't find them attractive. For years, Western biologists scoffed at the ignorance and superstitions of the natives for thinking that such a mythical beast was possible. In 1901, the intrepid Sir Harry Johnston came upon pygmy natives who had been kidnapped by a German explorer. Appalled at this atrocity, Johnston intervened, offering to pay handsomely for the pygmies' freedom. In gratitude, the freed natives gave him pelts and skulls they claimed were from the African unicorn. Unsurprisingly, when he brought them back to Europe, he was ridiculed. There was no way that these were the furs of an African unicorn, people scoffed, because the African unicorn didn't exist. When Johnston protested that although he had never saw the creature, the pygmies had shown him its tracks, the scientific community dismissed his claims and debated for years about his sanity. Then, in 1918, a live okapi, indeed a cross between the giraffe and the zebra, was captured in the wild and showcased in Europe. A decade later, the first Okapi was successfully mated in Antwerp. Today, the mythical Okapis, which apparently weren't so mythical after all, are now quite common in zoos across the world. In the 1970s, the Dalai Lama claimed that mere thought could change our brain structure. Even without the aid of modern brain scans and fMRIs, Western scientists knew that this was ridiculous. While it might be comforting to believe our brains can change, they said, it was only a myth. And certainly, if the brain could change, it couldn't do so through mere thought or force of will alone. For most of the 20th century, it was a commonly held notion in the most esteemed research circles that after adolescence, our brains were fixed and unyielding. Neuroplasticity, the idea that the brain is malleable and can therefore change throughout our lives, was essentially the Western unicorn. A few years later, some researchers began discovering tracks of what they claimed was this mythical chimera. This time, scientists found clues not in the skull of an Okapi, but inside the skull of a cabbie. Researchers were studying the brains of taxicab drivers who lived in London. Small wonder scientists get mocked at dinner parties for their overly specific research subjects. They found something previously unimaginable. The cab driver's brains had significantly larger hippocampi, the brain structure devoted to spatial memory, than the average person's. Why would this happen? To learn the answer, I went to the source, a living London cabbie. He explained to me that streets in London are not based on a grid system like much of Manhattan or Washington, D.C. As a result, navigating London is like navigating a Byzantine maze and requires that the driver have a vast internal spatial map. It's so difficult, drivers are forced to take a navigational test called the Knowledge before being licensed to drive one of the city's famous black cabs. Who cares? While a bigger hippocampus may not seem exciting to you, it forced scientists to confront the myth of neuroplasticity, that brain change is possible depending on how you live your life. Faced with this data, a scientist who held rigid to a fixed state brain model, which said that your brain does not change after adolescence, would be left with an awkward choice. Either he would have to argue that A, from birth, some people's genes develop a larger hippocampus because they know that they will one day grow up to become taxicab drivers in London, or concede that B, the hippocampus can increase in size as a result of many hours of practice driving a taxicab in maze-like surroundings. As brain scans became more sophisticated and accurate, more tracks of the mythical Western unicorn kept appearing. Imagine someone we'll call Roger, who could see normally growing up, but then suddenly lost his vision after toxic chemicals were splashed in his eyes during a high school chemistry experiment. After the accident, Roger was forced to learn how to read Braille, which required him to use his primary index finger to feel every word he read. When neuroscientists put someone like Roger in an fMRI machine to scan his brain, they made some startling discoveries. When they poked at the index finger of Roger's non-reading hand, nothing out of the ordinary happened. A small part of his brain would simply light up, just like it would if someone tapped on any of our fingers. But then came the extraordinary part. When researchers tapped on Roger's Braille reading finger, a relatively enormous area of cortical mass would light up, like a halogen lamp clicking on in his brain. To explain this, scientists again were left with two options. Either A, from birth, our genes are smart enough to anticipate a freak chemistry lab experiment and thus arrange for a well-hardwired index finger on just one hand. Or B, our brains change in response to our actions and circumstances. The answer in both cases above is obvious and inescapable. Brain change, once thought impossible, is now a well-known fact, one that is supported by some of the most rigorous and cutting-edge research in neuroscience. And the implications are far-reaching. Once our brains were discovered to have such built-in plasticity, our potential for intellectual and personal growth suddenly became equally malleable. As you're about to hear over the next 7 sections, Studies have found numerous ways we can rewire our brains to become more positive, creative, resilient, and productive, to see more possibilities wherever we look. Indeed, if our thoughts, daily activities, and behaviors can change our brain, the great question becomes not if, but how much change is possible. From possible to probable. What is the longest sequence of numbers a person can remember? How tall can a human being grow? How much money can one make? How long can a person live? The Guinness Book of World Records lists many of the greatest records set, the greatest potentials ever achieved. But the Guinness Book of World Records is a fossil record. It speaks only to what has been done, not how much can be done. That is why it has to be constantly updated. Records are forever being broken, so it is forever out of date. Take the fascinating case of the British middle distance runner Roger Bannister. In the 1950s, after rigorous testing and mathematical computations of the physics of our anatomy, experts concluded that the human body could not run a mile in under 4 minutes. A physical impossibility, the scientists said. Then along came Roger Bannister, who in 1954 seemed to have no qualms proving that it could in fact be run in 3 minutes, 59.4 seconds. And once Bannister broke the imaginary barrier, suddenly the floodgates opened. Scores of runners started besting the 4-minute mark every year, each one faster than the next. How fast does a human have the potential to run the mile, or swim the 100 meter, or complete the marathon today? Honestly, we don't know. That is why we hold our breath during every Olympic competition, to see if a new world record has been established. The point is, we do not know the limits of human potential. Just as we can't know the limit for how fast a human can run or predict which student will grow up to win a Nobel Prize, we still don't know the limits of our brain's enormous potential to grow and adapt to changing circumstances. All we know is that this kind of change is possible. The rest of this audio program is about how we can capitalize on our brain's capacity to change so that we can reap the benefits of the happiness advantage. Lasting positive change. If change is possible, the natural question is, how long does it last? Can utilizing these principles make a real, lasting difference in our lives? In a word, yes. As you will hear over the next 7 chapters, studies have confirmed numerous ways we can permanently raise our happiness baseline and adopt a more positive mindset. Since this audio program is about the happiness advantage, it's more than a little comforting to know that people can become happier, that pessimists can become optimists, and that stressed and negative brains can be trained to see more possibility. The competitive edge is available to all who put in the effort. I have also performed my own testing on the lasting effectiveness of positive psychology training. As previously mentioned, tests 1 week after the trainings at KPMG confirmed that employees were significantly less stressed, happier, and more optimistic as they began to implement the 7 principles. But once the honeymoon effect dissipated, did it make any real difference in their lives? Or did they just go back to their old habits once the workload rose? To answer this question, I revisited KPMG 4 months later. Extraordinarily, the positive effects of the study held. The control group's spirits inevitably rose somewhat as the economy crawled back from its bleak December 2008 low. However, the managers who had had the training reported a significantly higher satisfaction with life, greater feelings of effectiveness, and less stress. The life satisfaction score, which is one of the most crucial predictors of productivity and performance in the workplace, had improved considerably for those who had had the training. And more important, statistical analysis revealed that the training was responsible for the positive effects. Again, we saw that small positive interventions could create sustainable, long-term change at work. From information to transformation. I once spoke with a sleep researcher who had data to show that the more you sleep, the more gracefully you age. You must sleep 23 hours a day, I joked, as if he had never heard that one before. His face turned serious. Sean, I'm a sleep researcher. I stay up all night watching people sleep. I never